Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website funtrivia.com. First question is a true or false question. The saxophone is a woodwind instrument. Is that A, true, or B, false? And question number two, which of these instruments was once made out of wood but was replaced in the orchestra by the louder metal version? Was that A, the recorder, B, the trombone, C, the trumpet, or D, the flute? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of June the 19th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1937, that W2XBS, later WCBS-TV, televised the very first TV operetta. The work was The Pirates of Penzance by Gilbert and Sullivan, 1937 today. And it was 32 years ago today, 1988, that over 3,000 East Germans gathered at the Berlin Wall to hear Michael Jackson. Jackson was performing a concert on the other side of the wall in West Berlin, 1988. Today.
But the night I fell in love with her, I made my weakness known to the fighters and the farmers digging dusty fields alone. The jealous innuendos of the lonely-hearted men let me know what kind of country I was sleeping in.
Jason Isbell singing Live Oak introduces our country music news. It's a Q&A with Jason Isbell, entitled The Singer-Songwriter on his new LP, A Star Is Born, and hanging with Springsteen and Crosby. This is written by Brian Hyatt, published in Rolling Stone magazine, April 2020 issue. It's all based on a true story, says Jason Isbell, and it's all fiction. The roots-drenched singer-songwriter excellent new album, Reunions, is filled with tales of lost friends and other melancholy memories. But don't let his gift for novelistic detail fool you. The people he's mourning don't necessarily exist, just as it turns out that the meth-fueled college misadventures he detailed in 2017's Last of My Kind never actually happened. The one-time drive-by trucker's imaginative gifts served him well in 2018 when he wrote the utterly convincing Maybe It's Time for Bradley Cooper's character in A Star Is Born. I'm sure that's the biggest project I'll ever be a part of, says Isbell. Question. David Crosby is a fan of yours, and he sings backup on this album. What's your relationship like? Well, David is like your granddad, if your granddad was really stoned all the time. He'll call at 1 a.m, and he's really high, and he wants to tell you about an idea, and they're usually good ideas. His voice is still so powerful, and that surprised me because he's not always taken the best care of himself. I asked him, "How are you still able to sing like that?" He said, "I tried everything I could to kill it, but it just won't die. Question. One new song that seems drawn from your life is Letting You Go, where you imagine your four-year-old daughter getting married many years from now. That is a terrifying thing for a father to imagine, he responds. When my father-in-law was walking my wife, singer-songwriter Amanda Shires, down the aisle, when he got up to me, he stopped and would not hand her over. And now I think, man, I'd probably do the same thing. Letting You Go is one of your many, many tear-jerking songs from the Caner-like Elephant to If We Were Vampires, where a married couple grapples with the idea that one of them will inevitably die first. Do you, on some level, enjoy making listeners cry? Well, that, or making them laugh. If you make somebody make some type of noise unintentionally, you're doing a pretty good job as a songwriter. But there's something about the sad songs where it's not just sad, there's a resilience. And I think that's what really affects people. When you're painting a picture of people who insist on pushing through and surviving, that's where people really get moved, because that is at the heart of the human experience. You met Bruce Springsteen a few years ago. He sang one of your songs to you, right? Well, he goes, my son brought your record home, and I really liked that song. And then he started singing Traveling Alone. And I'm standing there thinking, he's singing my song in Bruce Springsteen's voice. And then I was like, yeah, because that's just what comes out of his face naturally, you know. He comes from a time when it was possible for people to write those kind of songs and sell millions of records and sell out arenas. If I'd come along in the 70s, I probably would have been a much bigger star, and I would have made a lot more money, and I would be dead. It would not have turned out well. I mean, more is not always better. Wagner's Rise of the Valkyries introduces our classical music news. It's a book review. The book, Sounds Like Helicopters, written by Matthew Lau. The review is written by R.C. Speck, published in WCPE Quarter Notes, Summer 2020. English professor Matthew Lau has written a book on the uses of classical music in modernist cinema. With Sounds Like Helicopters, we have a fascinating academic treatise on how classical music adds layers of meaning upon many of the most important films of the 20th century. What's nice about Sounds Like Helicopters is Lau's comprehensive research combined with his use of film theory, which is grounded in the works of postmodernistic thinkers such as Theodore Adorno and Walter Benjamin. He offers up the unexpected as well as the expected. Of course, Wagner appears front and center in this work as a kind of mystical anti-hero, brilliant but tainted by his appropriation by the Nazis. He makes a big impression in D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, an even bigger one in Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. Is this an ironic reference to Griffith's notorious film? A subversive dig at the Vietnam War? Or did screenwriter John Milius simply think that Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries would sound cool with helicopters in the background? As would be expected, Lau spills a great deal of ink on Stanley Kubrick. We're treated to an in-depth study of classical music in 2001, A Space Odyssey. In particular, Lau focuses on Richard Strauss's Also Sprach, Johann Strauss's On the Beautiful Blue Danube Waltz, and Ligeti's Atmospheres, and discusses whether such selections accentuate the coldness of Kubrick's films. Also at stake is how such music complements or undermines Kubrick's views on history and human evolution. Lau calls attention to the contradiction inherent in Kubrick's use of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in A Clockwork Orange. This contradiction reaches a crescendo during the famous Ludovico treatment scene, in which our protagonist, Alex, is forced to watch atrocities on screen while listening to Beethoven. This scene leads Lau to segue to Luis Buñuel's surrealistic short film Un Chien Andalou, which also features a grotesque treatment of a person's eye. Un Chien Andalou makes excellent use of Wagner as well, in particular Isolde's transfiguration from Tristan and Isolde. Lau covers a good part of the career of Buñuel, who in fact rated the classics for his films. Buñuel found use for Mendelssohn's Fingal's Cave, Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, and perhaps most famously, Handel's Hallelujah Chorus in Buñuel's brilliant comeback film, Vera Diana. For Lau, the Handel classic provides an ironic counterpoint to Viridiani's sense of charity in the famous beggar's banquet scene, which is in itself an ironic take on Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. Matthew Lau demonstrates quite clearly that many of the most notable films of the 20th century would not have been as memorable without classical music. Davis, all of you, introduces today's jazz music news. It's an obit. Jimmy Cobb, the pulse of Kind of Blue, dies at 91. This is written by Natalie Viner, published in NPR on the 25th of May, 2020. Jimmy Cobb, whose subtle and steady drumming formed the pulse of some of jazz's most beloved recordings, died at his home in Manhattan on Sunday. He was 91. The cause? Lung cancer. Cobb was the last surviving member of what's often called Miles Davis's first great sextet. He held that title for almost three decades, serving as a conduit for many generations of jazz fans into the band that recorded the music's most iconic and enduring album, Kind of Blue. It's impossible to overstate how much his playing, which propelled that all-star group forward, with delicate washes of cymbals and brush-stroked snare, contributed to Kind of Blue, undeniable bounce and feel. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled, Meet the Italians Making Music Together Under Coronavirus Quarantine. This is published in New Yorker magazine on the 19th of March, 2020, by Stephanie Taladrid. The language of music is common to all generations and nations, Rossini, the virtuosic opera composer, once said. It is understood by everybody, since it is understood with the heart. In recent weeks, Italians have embraced the language of music as a means to communicate with their neighbors and endure the ravages of COVID-19 as a collective. At a time when the most important music halls in the country, from La Scala to La Fenice, have closed their doors to the public. Citizens of all ages have used their own instruments and their voices to fill the silence of seclusion. Music has provided unity in times of division throughout history. Now Italians are showing the world that, if only for a moment, it can also help them transcend the anxiety brought by a pandemic. Italy is reporting thousands of new coronavirus cases daily. Although it's hard to say exactly when the amateur concerts began, they have coincided with the country's lockdown, which first took effect in northern Italy, where the virus was detected in late February. Italians from Bologna to Rome, they have invited their neighbors to engage in what they call a flash mob sonoro, or a sound flash mob. Musical competency is not a requirement, and neither is possessing a traditional instrument. A pot or a wooden spoon can suffice, if only because their sounds will join those of many other people who, from their balconies and windows, are hoping to create a bond through music. And this has been Chris Botti's playing Nessun Dorma in the background right now. Bunny playing the song April introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article entitled Beach Bunny, Chicago band turned songwriter Lily Trifilio's sad vibes into punky poppy rock anthems. This is written by Jonathan Bernstein, published in Rolling Stone magazine, May 2020 issue. 3 years ago, Lily Trifilio's needed musicians to help perform some songs she's written for a local battle of the bands. She ended up forming Beach Bunny, one of the best indie rock bands in America. Their debut album, Honeymoon, is full of fast-paced heartbreak songs like Mr. California, in which Trifilio spills her raging jealousy over super catchy pop-punk chords. The band also scored a hit on TikTok with 2018's body image commentary, Prom Queen. At the time, I didn't know my worth and I had lower self-esteem, says Trifilio, 23. Now I'm trying to write more empowering songs. Beach Bunny bring a carefree punk energy to their shows, or they might cover anything from Miley Cyrus's Party in the USA to a song from SpongeBob SquarePants. It's interesting to be singing the word cry or a really sad lyric, Trifilio says, but I'm just trying to open up the mosh pit. And in local music news, we have this article entitled The Piano Salon, Chapel Hill. This is published in Our State magazine, April 2020 issue, in an article entitled Homemade Jams. Line of well-dressed music lovers snakes down the driveway of Ken Gorfuckel's home in a wooded Chapel Hill neighborhood. In the foyer, guests remove their shoes before entering a living room with high slope ceilings and shelves filled with books on art, philosophy, and literature. The elephant in the room, a stunning 9-foot Bösendorfer concert grand piano. Nearby, world-renowned classical virtuoso pianist Marc-André Hamelin prepares to give a recital of the very same program of Prokofiev, Feinberg, and Schubert that he will perform later in the month at Carnegie Hall in New York City. Ken can hardly contain his excitement. At 72, the real estate developer has loved classical music for as long as he can remember. But when he got his Bösendorfer 2 years ago, he felt compelled, maybe even called, to share his passion. It got delivered, and I'm playing on it, and I'm feeling that I need other people in the world to hear this piano. It's a work of art in every way, he says. He sought advice on booking musicians from a professional promoter whom he'd gotten to know at events like the Southeastern Piano Festival in South Carolina. Soon, Ken was luring top musicians to his Chapel Hill piano salon. Tonight, Marc-André gives an extraordinary performance, his fingers gliding over the keys like feathers lighting upon leaves of grass. Every move, his arms, his shoulders, is as graceful as a ballet dancer's. And the emotion on the faces of the people gathered around the piano is palpable. Ken sits in the front row, eyes closed during soft passages, watching with fierce concentration in moments of intensity. It's just so intimate, and it's so personal. The music is so present, he said, and that's the way it is for everyone in the room. At a typical music hall, the first row is several feet from the stage. In Ken's living room, the back row is a mere 17 feet away from the piano. The farthest seat in any of my living rooms, he says, is closer than the closest seat at Carnegie Hall. So, how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, true or false, the saxophone is a woodwind instrument. Correct answer? True. The saxophone is a woodwind instrument. It was invented by Adolf Sax and was intended to be a hybrid woodwind and brass instrument. The brass body allows it to compete with the volume of the brass section. As noted by Kat Eschner in Smithsonian.com on the 22nd of March 2017, the designer of the saxophone, Belgian-born inventor Adolf Sax, initially applied for 14 instrument patents on the same day in 1846. His initial designs were also crafted from wood. In a way that makes sense, Sax's intent was to create an instrument that combined the relatively easy-to-play mouthpiece of a clarinet. Most woodwind instruments at the time were double-reeded like oboes, which is much harder to play, with the easy fingering of large woodwinds. Although the saxophone is still technically classified as a woodwind, a kind of instrument that uses a wooden reed rather than a brass mouthpiece, Sax quickly switched to making his instrument in brass. In its early years, the saxophone quickly went into use by French army bands, but Sax himself spent much time in court defending his patent, which then expired in 1866. In 1888, the sax came to America when a man named Charles Girard from Elkhart, Indiana, began making brass saxophones for military bands. By the early 1900s, the saxophone was a staple of American vaudeville, used as a comedy instrument. But it wasn't until the early 1920s that the saxophone became known as a serious instrument. That's thanks to a musician from New Orleans named Sidney Bechet. Bechet started out on clarinet and later in the early 1920s discovered the soprano saxophone, an instrument rarely heard in jazz at that time, according to NPR. But Bechet immediately took to the instrument, immediately creating an iconic sound on an instrument that would come to be a signature of jazz. Soprano saxophones are straight, but the most recognizable shape for a saxophone is curved, with the bell facing upwards. That's because of the physics of sound. The lower instruments would have to be awkwardly long to create the right pitch, and the curve simply allows the instrument to be a manageable size. After Bechet's innovation, jazz musicians began paying more attention to saxophones of all shapes and sizes. And the answer to our second question, which of these instruments was once made out of wood but was replaced in the orchestra by the louder metal version? Was that A, the recorder, B, the trombone, C, the trumpet, or D, the flute? Correct answer. Answer D, flute. As noted in theinstrumentplace.com, the flute is the oldest woodwind instrument dating to 900 BC or earlier. The first likely flute was called the ch'i and emerged in China. Early flutes were played in two different positions, vertically like a recorder, or horizontally in what was called the transverse position. A revolution in flute making took place in the second half of the 17th century. The instrument emerged as the Baroque flute with significant modifications, including the conical bore, the addition of a key for the right-hand little finger, and a more ornate body made in several pieces. The Baroque wooden flute has less holes than the modern-day flute and is softer and quieter in tone. So let's close out with flautist Ian Anderson from the British rock band Jethro Tull playing Johann Sebastian Bach's Bureau on his Selmer Gold Seal Flute. We've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.